Thank you so much, Betty. I had the lumber removed. I'm apt to be wandering around up here, and I was sure I'd step off and break my head, and I decided that I would. Besides, I'm so tall anyhow, I can see everybody, and that's the important thing to me, that I can see everybody out there. My name is Eve Marsh, and I am a very grateful alcoholic. Congratulations to you, Betty. Anniversaries are such wonderful days. What a celebration, isn't it? Because that's what life has gotten to be, I think, at AA, a celebration. We didn't used to think of it that way, but I think we've come to learn that it is a celebration as we go on being sober. Last night, Peter made the remark that when he first went into AA in Georgia, that he thought they were all crazy because they used to say they were grateful alcoholics. Well, when I first got sober, I used to hear people say, "I'm glad I'm an alcoholic," and I used to think they were really nuts. But you know, I am glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm not glad for the things that I did in my illness. I'm not glad for the hurts that I made and for all that I experienced and put others through. But I am glad that I'm an alcoholic because otherwise I wouldn't have found this wonderful program. This program of 12 suggested steps, which has made it possible for me to put my life in order, for me to get to know who I am, to get to understand the fact that the problem was not alcohol, it was me, and to do something about that. Because that, I think, is the thing we have to come to grips with. We have to come to an understanding of who we are, coming to an ability to assess our assets and our limitations with some degree of objectivity. Because for most of us, we've either been absolutely marvelous for half the time or absolutely beneath the depths on the other half of the time. Never able to find that level because we didn't have a real understanding of who we are and of that wonderful core of goodness that is within each and every one of us. Because we were all, as Shakespeare said, the divinity within that shapes our ends. He was a wonderful metaphysician, Shakespeare. He always said some very wise things. And so I'm very grateful that I'm an alcoholic. And I think that gratitude plays a tremendously important part in our recovery. I think that the ability to be grateful as things happen to us, instead of resenting the things that happen to us, is a tremendously important factor in this whole change that takes place in us if we're going to stay sober. And speaking of being grateful, I generally forget to thank all the wonderful people that have made it possible for me to be here, but I don't want to do that this time, because I am very grateful that Norman has included me once more in the plans for Sessions by the Sea. This is my third visit to Sessions by the Sea. The first one was when it was still quite small, and it was all over at the Hotel Plym Plaza. And I don't remember the year, but I thought it was a wonderful convention. There were 300 people there, and I just thought it was just terrific. And when I came back 5 years ago in 82, I was talking to some of my co-hosts of how nice it was to be back at a small convention. And he looked at me as if I were nuts, and he said, "We have 2,500 registered." Well, this year we've got 3,200. So you see, that's the way AA, that's the way AA grows. And it's amazing, isn't it? You know, talk about miracles. I wonder sometimes, you know, what about these miracles? What if, I mean, how our lives have been affected and touched by things that we might think of as being totally unrelated, but are really quite miracles when you stop and think about it. Perhaps you and I wouldn't be here if some of these little miracles hadn't taken place. What if Dr. Young had not taken the time to talk to Roland again after he'd drunk, after being treated and had failed? What if Dr. Young had not said to Roland, "You need to find some kind of a spiritual answer"? What if Roland hadn't sought that answer? What if Roland hadn't gone to the Oxford group? What if Ebby had not been an old friend of Roland's who picked up on some of the things that Roland was saying? And what if Evie hadn't got sober briefly? And what if Evie hadn't had a friend, Bill, whom he decided to go and talk to? And what if Bill hadn't said, "Oh dear, that's a lot of stupid stuff. I'm a scientist. I don't believe any God," and he went on drinking? Or what if, when he went into Towns Hospital after his last drunk, what if Dr. Silkworth had said to him after Bill had his wonderful spiritual experience, what if Dr. Silkworth had said, "Don't worry about that, Bill. It's just a DTs." But Dr. Silkworth didn't say that. He said, "Bill, this is a real experience, and I don't know what has you now, but what has you now is better than what had you before." And what if Bill had not tried those ministers and finally found one in Akron who would talk to him? who would give the name of a lady, Henrietta Seibel, who would say, what if Henrietta Seibel had said, I don't know any drunks? What if Henrietta Seibel had said, I don't want to have anything to do with drunks? But Henrietta Seibel said, I know a doctor who desperately is trying to stay sober. And what if Dr. Bob decided not to go and see Bill? And after they both got sober and they got Bill G on the band on the bed the third AA sober, what did they all decide to say to themselves? This is wonderful. We're sober. Let's keep it. What if they had decided not to share? Our lives hang by such miracles. Because without all those little things happening, the continuity of God's time, we wouldn't be here today. And neither would there be thousands of meetings all over the world today. Alcoholics just like you and me who have found an answer in this blessed program. And so I think gratitude is in order. I think we have so much to be grateful for. I'm one of those people who believes I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. There was no line for me to cross. I was there. And it's interesting, I think, when you stop and realize how little we really knew back when AA first started about alcoholism, in that big book of ours, that wonderful book, the AA book, how true it is. And yet, at the time that it was written, nothing was known. And yet, it has stood up over these years, these 55 years of AA, 50 years of the book. Even though our forefathers in AA really didn't know all that much, and neither did the rest of the world, about alcoholism, but they somehow knew that it was both physical, mental, and spiritual. And we have to understand that it is all three. It's interesting, when I was here 5 years ago, the Al-Anon speaker was absolutely marvelous, as was our Al-Anon speaker today, this week. But the point was that his name was Walter, I believe, and he began talking about himself. And I thought, this is an Al-Anon speaker? My God, this is an alcoholic. Because he had all the fears, all the insecurities, all the feelings that we have, but he wasn't an alcoholic. He didn't have the physical imbalance. He didn't have the biochemical imbalance. He didn't have the physical allergy, whatever it is. I guess the same thing would be true of Ray's husband. She talked about the fact that he drank a lot, but he wasn't an alcoholic. So we have to have the combination of these things. And of course, eventually we come to an understanding that the basic core is us. It's us. And so we have to learn, as we get sober, how to have the willingness to make the changes in ourselves that are necessary in order to affect your recovery. Because, you know, recovery is not an event. I used to think it was an event, you know. Ah, I've been sober 3 weeks! Isn't it wonderful? You know, on the wagon, hot dog. Yeah. It was an event, I'll tell you. But sobriety is not an event. Sobriety is a process. It's a process that we have to go through in order to know what it means to live sober. So I'm sure you have to forgive me. I have to keep drinking water all the time. I had radiation therapy a couple of years ago for cancer. It was wonderful. It killed the cancer, but it also killed all my saliva. So any of you who've noticed me having a little sip during the meetings, I assure you there's water in here. The reason I believe I was an alcoholic from the very beginning is because of what I was like. And that's what the big book says that we share, what we were like and what happened and what we're like today. I was an alcoholic from the very beginning because of me. I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. But I know that it is important for me to recognize the fact that it was what alcohol did for me that was the important thing. You know, for so many years we've been, looking at alcoholics and saying, look what the drinking is doing to him. Why doesn't he stop, or she? You know, it's what alcohol does to somebody that everybody used to look at. And we'd wait until they'd gotten all the way downhill, and then they'd finally say, well, maybe alcohol's the problem. Because it's been a problem from the very beginning, but nobody recognized it. Because the key is what alcohol does for us. And from the beginning, alcohol was important to me once I took that first drink. I was one of those people who was full of feelings of inferiority, of insecurity, of inadequacy. I removed the box down here because I'm tall. And of course, while I'm not exactly Brooke Shields, they didn't throw Brooke Shields in my day, but in my day, I was enormous. or thought I was. You know, I mean, I was all tall, I was gangly, I'm skinny again. I was skinny then, and I was elbows and knees, and then this huge nose. And of course, I thought that I was the homeliest person in the world. I was unattractive. I could not communicate with people. I didn't know how to reach out. I was all locked up in myself, all this terrible self-involvement, needing approval all the time, and feeling so inadequate on all scores. Feelings of lack, and feelings of not being a part of, feelings of being separate from. These were all the feelings that I think we're all familiar with. And I think that alcoholism is a feelings illness, and I think our program is a feelings recovery program. It's how we feel, and how we learn to handle our emotions, and how we learn not to react, if we ever learn that completely, but we can keep on trying. And so as I was growing up during those growing up years, I was miserable. I had two younger sisters who were both of them pretty, adorable, lovable, and not tall. And my mother had died, and I was just a mess. And not happy with myself, and not happy with the life around me. And I always had those feelings of lack, because my father was a writer, so we had the ups and downs. One year things were pretty good, another year things weren't so hot. But we all went to private school, because you had to in New York City in those days. I guess you still do, I don't know. But in any event, it was fine to go to the private school, but the problem was that my father didn't have the kind of money to keep up with the Joneses, if you know what I mean. So when I would go and visit friends from school and walk into their palatial mansions with butlers and chauffeurs and upstairs maids and downstairs maids and so on and so forth, I would feel so inadequate. Oh my God, we only have a housekeeper, you know. And I always had that feeling that money was going to be very important, and if I had money, it would prove something. I've changed my tune a little bit. So I had those feelings, and those feelings were very strong in me. And of course, I grew up during the Prohibition era. I went off to Vassar College in 1924. When I was 16, I'll save you the trouble, I'll be 80 my next birthday. And you know, I used to just say that, and I look at the audience, they're all busy going, you know, so save you the time. And that was during the Prohibition years, and everybody drank. And I understand the kids today with the peer pressure about the drugs and the pot, the smoking pot, and all the things they experiment with. Because the same kind of peer pressure was in evidence in my day then. Because if you didn't drink out of a hip flask, you didn't get invited to football games and fraternity dances and things of that kind, you were a wallflower. And I probably would have been a wallflower anyhow, because I didn't know anything about how to get along with people or the social graces. I mean, I didn't grow up properly, but I just couldn't do anything within. And I knew I was going to Europe at the end of my sophomore year. Back in those days, any father worth his salt sent his child to Europe for the grand tour. I think we had 5 chaperones for 17 of us. It was a little different from today's young travelers. But anyhow, 5 miles out, they began to serve. And I had never had a drink. I'd been afraid of it, kind of, as if I kind of knew I'd be out of control or something, that I would lose control. Anyhow, the person next to me ordered an orange blossom, and I didn't know what to order, so I ordered an orange blossom. And when I had that first drink, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. You know, all of a sudden, instead of being this huge, horrible hulk, I'm 5'2", eyes of blue, and adorable. Another drink, and I was able to communicate. I was able to reach out. I was able to chat. And as Peter said, he was even witty. So was I. So I had found an answer. You see, I think that's the biggest problem we have. We think that when we have found alcohol, we have found a solution. And it may be that we drink to escape. I don't know. I drank to cope. I had to drink in order to solve me. I had to drink to feel like anybody. I had to drink to accomplish things. I had to drink to handle the problems that came my way, or so I thought. And so I know I was an alcoholic from the very beginning, but nobody branded me as an alcoholic. I was 17 years old. You know, nobody said, oh my goodness, she's an alcoholic. They used to say, poor little Eve, you know, her mother died. Well, my mother died 5 years before. But people are willing to make excuses for us, or were then. I'm glad they've stopped doing that. I'm glad we've learned to confront people and to point up to them the fact that there's an illness from which we can recover. And so I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. I got back to college, and I, instead of being a wallflower, I got to be quite the belle of the ball. So much so that they asked me to leave at the end of my junior year. And that was one of the things that I look back at. Incidentally, everything I say is hindsight. The things that I can share with you about me then are things that I've learned about me then, since then, if you understand. Because I didn't know those things about myself then. But I can look back and I can see my poor father coming up, and I felt desperately awful, remorseful, degraded about the business of being kicked out of college. My mother had gone to Bathurst before me. My sister was coming the following year. And here I had been expelled. And I just felt terrible. And my father was coming to get me. But do you think I could share that with him? No. You know, all I could say was, oh, Dad, this place is terrible. Awful place. If they hadn't kicked me out, I'd have left anyway. But another thing happened that weekend that rather puzzled me. Because he came back after seeing the Dean of Women, and he said, you know, Dean Thompson tells me that you are the most arrogant young woman they've ever had in the freshman class. Arrogant? I was scared to death. And I have learned from that. When I see people, and we are often so, pardon me, I am often so judgmental to make quick decisions. What an arrogant SOB, you know, about some perfectly lovely human being. Wait a minute, Eve. Wait a minute. What does that arrogance cover up? Because so many of us have put up that tremendous front to hide the fear, to hide the self-doubt, to hide the insecurity that we feel deep down within. And so I got kicked out of college and decided I was going to go into the theater. My family were somewhat theatrical. I had an uncle who was a big actor and stuff. But anyhow, I didn't get very far. I was in it for about 9 or 10 years. But it wasn't until I got sober in AA that I began to look at what that was all about. And why had I wanted to go into the theater? You know, did I really want to go through all the hard work of being trained as a fine technician, projecting my voice to the last row in the balcony? They didn't have these things in those days. Learning to walk gracefully, dancing, and all this kind of thing. Did I want to go through all that hard work? Of course not. You know what I wanted? Instant stardom. My name in light. People rushing up to me to tell me how wonderful I was. And you know, I began to realize as I was going through the fourth step and trying to get to know who I was and what my feelings were all about, why was I doing that? Well, you know why. I was doing it for approval. I was doing it because I thought that if you said I was okay, then maybe I could think I was okay. But I didn't realize that then. And so I went on my way. Oh, I forgot to mention the fact that I started doing something else alcoholics do. I started getting married. And I got married and had a little boy. He's 57 years old now. God, a little boy. I guess it won't hurt him any if I tell you today that I got married because I was going to have a little boy. But I don't think he knows that. So anyhow, after the theater thing failed me and I had the little boy to support and all the rest of it, I really didn't know where I was going. I was kind of aimless in life. And then I met a wonderful guy. He was wonderful because he drank the same way I drank. And I thought, isn't this marvelous? I was so sick of people criticizing me for my drinking, you know. And so anyhow, we fell in love. We were, and we had everything going for us that marriage should mean. We really did love each other. We cared about each other. He had been in the radio business for a long time, and I thought that was romantic and exciting. I didn't recognize the fact that the reason he was working for his family's business now was because he couldn't be employed at radio anymore. That never dawned on me. But anyhow, we got married, and I thought everything was going to be wonderful. Because we did. We cared about each other. We had a lot in common. He was a beautiful human being, as alcoholics often are. But unfortunately, we were both alcoholics, and neither one of us knew anything about it. Didn't know much about alcohol in those days. And my little son came to live with us, and it was wonderful that I had him with me again after 3 or 4 years of farming him out with nurses and governesses while I was on tour. And so I thought life was going to be wonderful. And we had 2 beautiful daughters of our own. But here again, alcohol was a part of our lives. a desperate part of our lives. And as it says in the big book, we don't ever want to forget the things. We don't want to dwell on the things in the past, but we don't want to forget them either, because that is what happens to us if we lose this program, if we don't continue to try and keep AA a vital, viable part of our daily lives. And so I remember my feelings. I remember how I felt. I remember the lack of worth that I felt. I remember the degradation I felt. I remember the despair that I felt when I would promise my son over and over again that I was not going to drink and I would come home drunk. When I would look back now and think of the number of times that I left my little girls, my little Ruthie was about 3 and she'd be wandering around the apartment all by herself. And little Liz, I had a little canvas swing that sort of hung in between the dining room and the living room. We lived on Riverside Drive in New York. And she'd be in that little canvas swing and Mommy would pass out. And she'd spend hours in that little canvas swing and little Ruthie running around all by herself. How could I not believe in a higher power when I come to face the fact that those children are safe and alive today? And so all these things made me feel so degraded and so shameful. And I can remember speaking to the children and saying, we're going to the park, and then I'd be so hungover I couldn't go. And you know, in New York City, you take your children out. You can't just put them out. You have to take them out. And they'd say, Mommy, we want to go to the park. And I'd say, Mommy can't. She's too sick. I'd be sitting there in an old pink chenille wrapper, shivering and perspiring combination, you know. And as I said, I'm too sick, I hated myself because I thought I was lying. I thought I wasn't sick. I thought I was degraded. I thought I was beyond the pale. I thought I was worthless and hopeless and degraded. And I was in despair. I didn't really believe that I was ill because I didn't understand that alcoholism was an illness. And so time went on, and I finally reached that point that we all of us have to reach, I suppose, that point beyond which I couldn't go, that point beyond which my fear was greater. I think that really is it. I think we reach a point where our fear of trying to live without alcohol becomes less than the fear of living with it. No, I've said it backwards. I knew I was going to. When our fear of going on becomes greater than our fear of trying to live without it. Because alcohol was such an important part of my life, I didn't know how I could live without it. But I finally reached that point beyond which I couldn't go. And I made up my mind that I had to do something. I had read the Jack Alexander article in 1941, but of course I didn't read it for me. I read it for that SOB drunken husband of mine, you know. I thought, well, if Roger will get sober, then I won't have a problem, because he's my problem. I didn't recognize the alcoholism was my problem. And I remember looking at that article, and the subtitle of it was Freed Slaves of Drink. And I remember thinking, how corny can you get? I was so sophisticated, you've no idea, you know. Freed Slaves of Drink, really. Incidentally, may I ask you a question? How many of you smoke or have smoked? May I ask again, how many of you have stopped smoking? Isn't it wonderful? I want to make a point. You understand freedom. You know, the telephone rings. You pick it up and say hello. When we were smoking, telephone rings. Where's my cigarette? Where's my goddamn cigarette? Where's the cigarette? Telephone ring. Where's the cigarette? Well, I suggest to you that's freedom. But Freed Slaves of Drink, I didn't understand. I didn't know what freedom was all about. I hadn't read the big book. I didn't even know what the big book was. I didn't know that in the promises section it talks about freedom, the ability to have freedom and happiness that we had never ever dreamed possible. But Roger wasn't interested in reading it and wasn't interested in AA, and so I had gone on drinking until finally, in this spring of 1944, oh, my beautiful flower, I forgot to thank you for. Did I thank the committee for inviting me? I was going to. Oh, good. And for the flower and for the beautiful stirrup cup, I always forget these things. Thank you for the beautiful flower. Oh, where was I? Anyhow, in the spring of 1944, I'd reached that point beyond which I couldn't go. My son couldn't stand me. He looked at me with great distaste. He was then 14 years old, and I knew he didn't love me anymore, and I felt so abysmally despairing and degenerate almost And so I decided that I would try and go to AA, and I asked Roger if he would go with me, and he refused. And I was so full of fear. Talk about fear, Peter. Oh, that fear, that terrible fear, that anxiety, that overwhelming sense of nothingness was so horrible. And I was afraid to go alone. I had always thought that I was afraid of people. It took me a while in AA and the fourth step to understand that what I was afraid of was what people would think of me, not what they would do to me, but whether or not I would have their approval. But that took some time in AA to discover. And so I didn't go, and I went away for the summer with the children, and of course drank again, and finally got back into New York, and in October of 44, I called AA, and I started in. But I didn't make it, not right away. I got very angry. Anger is something that we live with, but it would come out in rage sometimes, and I had blind rage at my husband. He was beating up my son, his stepson. In a rage, after I got everything quieted down, I walked into the kitchen and poured a half a tumbler of whiskey and drank it down and said, "I'll show him, the son of a," you know. And of course, I didn't show anybody except myself. And the result was I had another month of drinking until finally in January 6th, 1945, I had my last drink. And it's been a wonderful way of... It's easy. Just go to meetings and don't die. And when I went down to the old 24th Street Clubhouse, and I've always been glad that I was able to get sober in that historical place of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood out in the street, and I was full of fear, and there was a long hall that went down to a big room at the end of the hall, and the hall was dark, and I could see light at the end of the hall, and I looked there, and I was so frightened, and I didn't know whether I dared walk down that hall or not, but I did, thank God, and I walked into this room of light, and I found light and life and love and all the things that have been worthwhile and meaningful in my life ever since. Because AA has really and truly meant my life. I was 36 or 7 when I got sober. I'll be 80 on my next birthday. And it has been, it's just the fact that it really AA has been such a dominant part of my life. It's more than, now I've been sober longer than I was before, you know. But what am I saying? I am glad I was an alcoholic, because without it, I just would have been a sick me. I wouldn't have had this program to learn to live by. But once I was able to surrender the fact that I was an alcoholic, and oh my God, was I grateful to find out I was an alcoholic. Somebody else talked about that. I was so delighted to know that I had an illness that was, well, it may not have been totally respectable, but it was at least, well, halfway okay, you know. It was better than being nuts. It was better than being a degenerate. It was better than being all the things they used to cause, you know. So I was delighted I was an alcoholic. And talk about anonymity. You know, in the old days, the big book, when I first came in, had a bright red and yellow paper cover, not the discreet blue cover we have today that you can turn around so that you can have a plain blue, nobody know what you're reading, you know. We had this big red, bright orange, red and yellow cover, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd go to meetings. We eventually moved to 41st Street, and I would go down to meetings on the bus, and I'd come back, and I'd have the book, you know, and hold it up, sitting on the bus, hoping people would say, "Look at that nice lady, and she's an alcoholic." God. Screwing. But that's all I felt about AA. I felt proud that I was in AA, and I am today proud that I'm in AA. As well as being grateful, not a false pride, not pride that I'm doing anything, but pride in the fellowship, pride in what this fellowship has meant worldwide, pride in the lives that it has saved, pride in the fact that if the rest of the world would live by it, we might have something, you know? I remember a good many years ago when I was still at General Service, Bill used to come in pretty often in those days. In fact, he was in for a long time every day, but toward the end he didn't stay in quite as often. But anyhow, he'd been sitting in the office, and I saw him walking down the hall, and I got up out of my chair and went over and I said, Bill, you look as if you just swallowed a canary or something. You look so happy. What happened? What's up? Oh, he said, Evie, there wouldn't be any more new experiences. Today is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And that's what we learn to do in the fellowship of AA. But I didn't know all that then. I just thought, isn't it wonderful? I don't have to drink. And I just thought that was it. I just put down the bottle, don't drink, and everything's wonderful. I had no idea of the amount of work and effort that I was going to have to put in on change. And first off, on the willingness to change. Or maybe I should say first off, the recognition that I needed to change. And once I'd had that awful drunk after my anger and rage at my husband, I began to recognize the fact that there were things about me that weren't okay. And I began to slowly work on the steps. The first step was easy. I was so glad. I know I was an alcoholic. That was wonderful. And there was no question of acceptance on my part. I was totally accepting of that fact. I knew it. I knew it from the very beginning. And came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That wasn't difficult. I knew I'd done insane things while I was drinking. I knew the way I acted was nuts. And if you wanted to get really fine-tuned about it, sanity really means health anyway. So there was no problem with accepting the fact that a power greater than myself. I knew I couldn't do it. I had trouble with what that power was. I had trouble with that, what that power was. I had no real concept about God. I'd bargained with God. I had experimented in trying to find out about God. But I felt guilty. I made a terrible mistake. I did something I think that many of us do because of the sickness of our ego. I said, I'm not worthy of God's love. And I didn't realize that that is the most egotistical thing that we can say. And so at the third step, I kind of bounced around a little bit. I didn't make that decision. I thought I had to know what the higher power was before I could make the decision. And that isn't it. You make the decision first, and then comes the willingness to explore and to find out. But I was fortunate in that the 11th step became very meaningful to me, and so I kind of combined the two. And I thought that 11th step was wonderful, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And I had a wonderful demonstration of how meaningful that step can be with a little experience that I had. I was terrified of New York subways, absolutely terrified of them. And there was a time when I had to go down to Wall Street, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to make it in that subway. I just can't make it, but I've got to, unless I want to go down and spend the day on the bus and spend the night down at Wall Street and come back the next day. I'd have to go on the subway, and I got on the subway, and you know those awful feelings of the palpitation and the sweat in the palms of your hand and the fear, and I was hanging on that strap, absolutely riddled with this fear, afraid I was going to faint any minute. Neurotic fear, my dear, is just as serious as a real fear. Is there any difference? I don't know. But anyhow, I remember what they said in AA about saying a prayer, and I couldn't think of what a prayer was. And so all of a sudden, I began to recite the 11th step to myself, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious time. And I want to tell you, a miracle happened. The fear left me, the perspiration left me, my heart returned to normal, and I rode all the way down on that subway, reiterating that 11th step over and over in my mind. And I proved to myself that prayer works. By little things like that, we can, you know, learn so much from little experiences that we don't perhaps fully appreciate it at the time. I'm not sure I fully appreciated that at that time. It's in looking back that I can see what a turning point that was for me. And then the fourth step. To me, the fourth step is a terribly important step because I don't think most of us know ourselves at all. And I had to really look at this person that I thought I was. And I was so different, really, from what I thought I was. And so often we've taken the ideas that other people have given to us and taken that as gospel. All the things people have said to us about how awful we are, or about how useless we are, or about how this and that. And I can remember once my husband looked at me, my dear, sweet, alcoholic husband, and he looked at me and he said, you know, you're the homiest goddamn woman I ever knew. And I believed him. I didn't think he was much either, if you want to know the truth. And I had had to learn that I had to change, but I also had to learn that there are some things we can't change. And I had to learn which was which. And I had to learn that even though there are things I can't change, there are things I can change about the things I can't change. For example, I am tall. I used to hate it and felt awkward and slouched and all the rest of it. But I've changed the way I feel about being tall. When I see my little 5'2" daughter try to get something off the top shelf that she has to get out a damn ladder and all the rest of it, I say, wait a minute, honey. And I got it. I'm glad I'm tall. It's a change of attitude. And this great huge nose of mine, oh, you know, years. If I ever get enough money, I'm going to get a nose job. If I ever have enough money, I'm going to get this bump off, you know. Never was enough money. How could it be with two alcoholics and with three kids and doctors and summer camp and, you know, the routine? Well, it's a good thing. Now it holds my glasses up. And so the willingness to change becomes all important. Because it isn't important what happens to us, we learn. The important thing is how we react to what happens to us. And that's what the AA program is all about. Learning how not to react. Learning how not to react to every little thing that happens. You know, so often the things that we do about reacting are a result of not living in today. What's a resentment? A resentment is a re-feeling, something that happened in the past. So we're not really living in today if we're living with a resentment. And yet resentment is our number one problem. It's based in fear. I often think fear is really the number one problem. But resentment, if you come right down to it, is based in fear. Because when you have a resentment, take a look at it. What are you resenting? You know, you're afraid somebody's going to take something away from you that you think is yours. That guy's going to take your wife, or that girl's going to take your husband, or that guy's going to get your job, or that guy's going to get a raise you should have. You know, resentment is based on fear. Fear of lack, fear of loss. And resentment is the most destructive thing in the world for us, and it does absolutely no good. And I remember once, after I had finally divorced Roger. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I did do that, yeah. But anyway, Roger and I finally came to the parting of the ways after I had been sober about 6 years. And during those 6 years, he had been drunk every night. And I found that I could no longer, there was no Al-Anon then. And I was taking his inventory instead of mine. I was trying to sell him the AA program instead of working on it for myself. And it really is a miracle that I stayed sober during that time. But in any event, I did, and we finally were separated. And shortly after we were separated, a big, tall, gangling guy in AA began paying attention to me. I think I was 40-ish at the time, and I remember thinking, God, maybe life isn't over. Whee! You know. Whew. And we went to meetings together, and we necked in the back of the car, and, you know. And I was pretty flurry about this. And I thought it was pretty terrific. And all of a sudden, he began going with another girl. Well, of course, rejection immediately. And I wept, and I stormed, and I cried in my house. I never saw anybody else see me do it. And anger, and resentment, and I refused to go any meetings where I thought they might be. I'll show them. So I deprived myself of good meetings because they might be there. Went to other meetings I didn't like, so I wouldn't see them. But one night I happened to run into them by mistake. They were so happy. And I was in a rage. And that made me so damn mad that I made up my mind it was stupid to have a resentment. Because I was the one that was hurting. I was the one that was angry. I was the one that was distraught. They were as happy as clams. Couldn't have cared less whether I was in a resentment or happy or what I was doing, you know. And I'm in this terrible twit. It made me think of that little limerick that I guess we're all familiar with. Here lies the body of old John Gray. He died maintaining the right of way. He knew he was right as he drove along. So he's just as dead as if he'd been wrong. Right, Bob? And so I began to work on myself and to recognize the fact that I needed to make these changes, that I needed to learn how to deal with my emotions. I needed to learn, most of all, who I was. I had to learn that I was okay. I had to learn that there was something down inside of me that was wonderful. And you know, so many of us, when we take that fourth step, all we can think of is the awful things about us. You know, that list of things that are wrong with us is so much bigger than the things that are okay. And I've always been very grateful during my early years of sobriety. At a closed meeting one day, I was talking about this, that I couldn't find anything good. Of course, that's ego, but anyway. Marty was at that meeting, and Marty said, "You know, Evie," she said, "you know, you mustn't do that, dear. Stop and emphasize the things that are good about you. Think about the good things, the good qualities that you have, and build on them." Oh, this was a wonderful idea that I'd never even thought of. I couldn't find any. So I began to stew about that, but I finally recognized the fact that I had a tremendous amount of love inside, even though I had it all locked up. I knew I loved my children more than life itself, and I thought, well, that's a good quality. And so I began to try and make sure that I was acting that way, and if things like resentment and anger and rage and self-pity and all those things got in the way of my doing what I knew I wanted to do as a loving parent, then I could recognize that that had to be gotten rid of. It would be like weeding a garden in order that the roses could grow and flower and get rid of those weeds of resentment and self-pity and anger. And so I began to have a better look at myself and began to come to a recognition of myself that there is good in all of us. My God, we're wonderful. Stop and think about it. We are unique. There are not two of us anywhere alike. We're made in the image and likeness of God. But God's not made in the image and likeness of us. He doesn't necessarily have to look like a human being. We all of us have our own concepts of what God is. But we are made in the image and likeness of some created spirit, whatever it is. And none of us are the same, not even two identical twins. And think what a marvelous thing this body is. Those of you who are having difficulty in finding out what kind of a higher power you believe in, take a look at this miraculous thing that we live within. This temple that we abide in. Look at this brain better than any computer that was ever built. This body that functions so beautifully without our doing anything and our misuse of it. Look at the abuse we did with the alcohol and some of us with drugs. The abuse we gave, well, and yet we're wonderful. You go into an AA meeting and lots of times you'll look at a couple and you'll say, "Oh, I guess that man must be a terrible alcoholic. Isn't the woman lovely?" You discover she's the alcoholic and the poor old husband's been living with it all these years. You know, I mean, you can't tell, kid. This is a marvelous body we have. This is a marvelous thing we have. And the thing that drives it is this thing within, this inner something, this inner spirit. As Bill says in the chapter to the agnostics, the great inner reality. And I heard a minister say once, "I believe that God is an inner reality, not a distant possibility." And that to me is very meaningful. And so I began to work through the steps and try to recognize my shortcomings and try to recognize those failings that I wanted to get rid of, but most of all to be willing. And they used to say to me, "Act as if." I said, "What do you mean act as if?" "Well, act as if. You don't get along with Hank. Well, act as if you loved him." "What? Act as if I loved that SOB while that bastard..." Oh, excuse me. "Well, that'd be hypocritical. I can't do that." But I soon learned that if I acted as if, things began to happen. And they used to say to me, get yourself out of the way. So, what do they get myself out of my own way? What do they mean? Emerson says it best. He says, get your bloated nothingness out of the way of the divine circuit. And the divine circuits are life and love and truth and beauty. And we block that out through our own self-will. And you know, when we put this wall around us to protect ourselves so that you can't get in, we have also put a wall there so we can't get out. And most of us want so desperately to get out. Most of us want so desperately to be loving, to love, and to be loved. But that old fear of rejection stands in our way until we learn to love ourselves. Until we learn that we are wonderful, can be. We don't live up to perfection. We don't live up to what we should be. But we're trying because we're in the process of becoming. And we go on becoming as we keep on growing in the AA program. Growing away from that need to have anything outside. We have needed outside things to make us feel okay. We have needed something outside of us to make us feel whole, to fill up that emptiness that Peter spoke of last night. We all of us are acquainted with that emptiness, never feeling as if we were whole. And what we've come to learn in AA is that we are whole, that we are whole people. And until we are whole persons, we have nothing to offer anybody else. And so we learn to love ourselves. And as we learn to love ourselves and forgive ourselves, and you know the opposite of forgive is to punish and condemn, and that's what we do to ourselves. We hate ourselves, we punish ourselves, and we keep saying to ourselves things like, look what I did. And I implore those of you who are new and working the program and into the fourth step, don't confuse what you did with what you are. What we are is something wonderful. What we did as a result of the illness. Of course, if you go on doing those things after you get sober, you're just a bastard, and that's too bad. I'm not saying we're all perfect, but we all have the potential. We all have the potential of becoming. And as long as we have that willingness to change, and to change our attitudes, and to lose the fear, and learn how to love, and rejoice in that loving. Rejoice in that loving. You know, I talked about being a celebration for Betty. Life is a celebration for us in AA. It's a time of rejoicing. I don't mean that everything is wonderful. Look at the things that Peter and Don have lived through and how tremendously they've come through. They couldn't have done it without the program, I'm sure they both say. I feel very grateful. I've had problems, of course, we all of us do. I haven't had anything as horrendous, perhaps, as they have experienced. But they've been meaningful things to me. It isn't easy to divorce a husband that you love. It isn't easy to find your grandson into drugs. It isn't easy to find out these things. It isn't easy to work through these things. It isn't easy to watch your beautiful daughter go downhill and go down the tube. And I remember that beautiful little daughter. Once she came running home one day and she said, "Oh, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up." And I said, "What do you want to be, darling?" She said, "I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA." She never got to be the ballet dancer. But she's got 10 years of sobriety in AA. So she got her wish. And oh boy, was that hard for me to let go. I was the last person in the world that could help my daughter. And it was very hard to let go. Thank God for Al-Anon. I have a daughter who's an Al-Anon. We have really quite a family in a way, because my AA daughter is married to an AA gentleman, and my Al-Anon daughter is married to an Al-Anon gentleman. I don't know how in the world she found an Al-Anon man, but she did, and she got him. And we have wonderful discussions, you know, wonderful times together. Of course, you know, sometimes Al-Anons get a little too much. And so there's three of us in AA, so we just say, "Oh, shut up." Or we'll remind them of what an Al-Anon slip is, you know what that is, one moment of compassion. So I went on trying to work the AA program, trying to affect the changes in myself that I knew were important and necessary to me if I wanted to become the kind of person I'd always wanted to be. And thank God, as I said, we never graduate. We go on changing. We go on growing. And that, to me, is the excitement of it. That, to me, is the excitement of the AA program. This business of being able to change, this business of being able to cope, of waking up a new day. Each day is going to hold something different. They're not all the same. They may seem sometimes like a sameness, but nonetheless, things are going to happen and we can cope with it. And the excitement and the enthusiasm of it all. You know, a few years back, somebody asked me to do a lecture on alcoholism and the elderly woman. I couldn't figure out why they were asking me to do that, but I don't like the word elderly. And so I went to the dictionary. Like Peter, I'm a dictionary freak. I go to the dictionary and look up words when I want to find out what I'm talking about. And I found a wonderful definition of elderly. The definition of elderly is a loss of enthusiasm for life. That's it. And you know, we in AA will never lose that enthusiasm for life because we've really learned how to live. We have rules to live by and a program to share. And we have found a fellowship of love that we never thought existed. My goodness, I never would have dreamed that I would have so many friends in the world. And so I went on making the effort to try and grow and change, and I've been so grateful because so many wonderful things have happened to me in the fellowship of AA. I went to the New York Intergroup office after I left Roger, as Roger and I were divorced, and I went to work as a secretary or coordinator at our local office in New York City. And it was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot about the traditions. I learned a lot about working with groups and unity. It was important. And then I went up to the General Service Office at that heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous, that worldwide center where we answered letters from all over the world, letters of inquiry from doctors and nurses, from industrialists, from employers, from alcoholics, from families, from around the world. And I got so hungry, I wanted to see how AA was working in all these faraway places. I was on the international desk for a good many years. And so finally I thought, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have a leave of absence and go away for a year and still have a job to come back to. See, I still felt so insecure about my ability to hold down any kind of a job except in AA that I wanted to be sure I had a job to come back to because my kids were still going to college and stuff. And finally it happened, and I had a year off. And I went around the world, and I spent the whole year traveling. I got on a freighter in New York and headed forth. I traveled by train, I traveled by air, I traveled by ship, I traveled by elephant. It was an exciting year, and I visited AA everywhere. And I found that AA is everywhere. And I found that people would say to me, you know, the greatest export the United States has ever made is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe it. And I had some wonderful experiences that pointed up so often the things that we accept every day as just being a part of our routine. I remember when I got to Tokyo, I was asked to go to a meeting and the office wanted me to check on whether or not certain literature should be translated into Japanese. And so I took a cab from the hotel. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening. It was pitch dark. And they told me it was at St. Albans Church. And the Japanese will write down on the paper for the cab driver where you're going and the name of your hotel when you come back, so because they don't understand English, and my Japanese is limited. So I went to this church, and it was a big church, and it looked as if it was crumbling and falling down. There were broken steps, and I tried to get in. It was dark, and there was nobody there, and finally two girls in the cab left, and two girls walked out, little Japanese girls, and so I shouted at them, you know, if you yell, well, you think they can understand you better. And I asked where St. Albans Church was, and then they smiled, and they pointed, and it was a very modern building over here. And so I went trotting over there, and I said, do you know where the AA meeting is? They said, yes, it's upstairs. So I went up the stairs, and there was a hallway, and there were doors opening off the hallway, and I looked at this door, and it said third grade. And I listened, I didn't hear anything, so I went on to the next door, and it said second grade, and I listened, and I couldn't hear anything. And I went on to the next door, and it said first grade, and I didn't hear anything, so I went on to the next door, and it said kindergarten. And I put my head up against the door and I heard, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I thought to myself, that's right. That's where we belong, in the kindergarten. In the kindergarten, because we're just learning how to live. We're just learning how to really live, not just exist as we did when we were in the grip of our compulsion. And then once when I was in Australia, it was kind of fun. They're terribly anonymous over there. They've got a lot of AA, but they're very, very anonymous. You know, it was all bow tie Alf and racetrack Harry, and I had difficulty knowing who people were. But in any event, I did a lot of talking, of course, naturally. They went to the airport to see me off in Adelaide. We had a big public meeting the night before. And I reached for my ticket, and I saw this envelope that had Mrs. Marsh written on it. And so I went over to take it, and the chap behind the counter said, just a minute. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was mine. Well, he said, I'm not sure. He said, are you Eve M? I said, yes. Well, he said, we have a telegram here. Do you know Fred Epp? So I turned around to the people with me and I said, do I know Fred Epp? And they said, he was in the chair last night, my dear. Oh, yes, I know Fred Epp. So the man smiled and said, well, I guess telegram is for you then, Mrs. Marsh. You were the only M on the manifest, but we had to make certain. And here was his telegram addressed to Eve M, Answer Airlines, Adelaide, Australia. Thank you for coming. Hope we'll see you again. Love from us all. Signed, Fred F. Now, I subscribe to you that that broke my anonymity a hell of a lot more than if they'd sent it to Eve Marsh. Because I didn't have AA member pinned on me. I think this anonymity is so misunderstood sometimes. And I think the power we have in sharing our experience, strength, and hope with the rest of the world, not at the public level, but in our own private domain, is too tremendous to hide. We may be the only alcoholic recovered anybody sees. And the only reason that I ever mention how long I've been sober to newer people or anything like that is I want them to know that we wouldn't stay sober 42 and a half years if we didn't learn to have a hell of a good time. Because life is exciting. And so life has been wonderful to me since I got sober in this beautiful fellowship. And the gifts that we have been given are truly wonderful. When you stop and realize the friends we have, the love we share, the ability to meet new situations, new crises, the ability to wake up in the morning and know that it's going to be a wonderful day, the ability to go to bed at night and take a look. Didn't like the way I spoke to her. That was nasty. I'll apologize tomorrow. Thank you, Father. Thank you, Father, for a beautiful day. You know, our days are beautiful, even those days that we wish we'd done something different, because we can learn from it. There's nothing ever lost. There's nothing ever lost. This fellowship is such a miracle. It in itself is a miracle. And each of us is probably an individual miracle. But I think we have to come to an understanding and a recognition of the fact that those old feelings that we had of being apart from instead of a part of being separated, were based on the fact that we were cut off and separated from our source. And that source is whatever we want to call it. That source is our creative force, our higher power, our God. And when we come to AA, we can fully believe what it says in the book of John. God is love. Who dwells in love dwells in God, and God in him. I love you.